Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm very happy that you are joining me to talk a little bit about classic baseball cards. We're out of the junk wax era. No, we left that big old monster box a long time ago, right in the middle of the big old binder as we move into the 70s. And we bring you one of the most popular and favorite sets of all times, although one of the most maddening sets to collect in pristine mint condition. And that would be the awesome 71 top set. Best known for its black borders, best hated for its black borders, but also a lot of other innovations that Topps unveiled in the 1971 set. And after a very bleh finish to the 60s, and in my opinion, not a great start to the 70s, with the 1970s set, 71 Topps really reinvigorated the Topps brand and baseball cards in general. Baseball cards would not be the same with how players were projected in action in a lot of cases throughout the 1970s and then, of course, into the junk wax era in the mid to late 80s. And our random poll from the 71 Topps collection that I have, number 490, Darren Johnson. Big power-hitting first baseman, most notably for the Philadelphia Phillies, but he also won a World Series with the Athletics in 1973. And unfortunately, Darren Johnson has become, and I hate to use the word forgotten, because as long as you have a baseball card and you've got stats at baseballreference.com, and Darren Johnson played a very, very, very long time in the big leagues, you're not really truly forgotten. But Johnson played for some really bad teams. Like I said, he did win a World Series with Oakland, but he played for the Phillies and the Kansas City Athletics and kind of bounced around later on in his career as a designated hitter in the American League. So he doesn't quite get the attention he probably deserves. And also, unfortunately, he passed away quite a while ago, back in 1992. And I think there's a couple generations of baseball fans who have no idea who Darren Johnson is, but he was an absolute beast at the plate. Not only hit a lot of home runs, but also some mammoth home runs. And we'll talk a little more about Darren Johnson's life and career as we talk about the epic 71 top set. Now, before we get to talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, just a little bit of housekeeping here. We do have a new item up for bids in our auction. And this is one, the auction started a little later than I wanted it to. We normally do it over the weekend, but I was out of town on business this weekend and didn't really have my stuff in order to do it. But if you are listening to this on the first day or the morning of the second day that the podcast is posted, that would be June 27th or the morning of June 28th. We do have an item up for bids. It is an 84 Topps rack pack, and it's not the grocery rack pack. This is more the traditional rack pack with the three separate packs that are strung together. And 84 Topps is already a very popular set. It's a popular design. But this item, I think, will raise the eyebrows of a few San Diego Padres fans, as one of the cards that is visible on this rack pack is Tony Gwynn's second year card. And by all appearances, at least the back of the card is in pristine condition. While 84 Topps Tony Gwynn's no longer fetch $10 or $12 like they did back in the day, it is still worthy of a few dollars. And if you do win this auction and you look at the card and you decide you want to get it professionally graded, if it comes in as a PSA 9 or 10, I have seen those priced at a couple of $100. So there is some potential if you're looking just for a financial boost through this auction. You can get it from there. But also, and I noted this in a tweet yesterday, the 84 Topps rack packs had 54 cards. This was mainly because of competition. You know, Fleer and Donruss finally raised their game in 83 and 84, and Topps had to do it as well. So not only did they put out a very popular set in 84 that was a pretty solid follow-up to the 83 set, but they had to just put out more numbers. You know, if you buy a rack pack from Topps, you were going to get more cards than you did with Fleer or Donruss. So you not only get this Tony Gwynn second year card, but you also have a pretty decent chance of getting a second year Boggs, second year Sandberg, also Ricky Henderson, Cal Ripken, and of course the big card from the 84 top set, Don Mattingly. Now, because there were plenty of 84 tops cards produced and many still in existence, again, you're not paying off student loans with any of these cards, but a pretty good set to pick and choose from, and one lucky winner of that auction will receive the cards after we do the video break of them, probably on Thursday. So if you are interested in bidding on that, just DM me at Wax and Gum Stains with your bid. The opening bid was $8. We'll kind of track it along here and see where things go. I don't imagine it'll get too high in price like our 77 Tops pack did a couple weeks back. But 84 Tops with the Tony Gwynn showing, the rack pack with 54 cards is up for bids. DM your bids. The highest bidder on noon Eastern Wednesday will win the rack pack and win the cards after we break them open. So we've got that going on. Also, I wanted to let people know one reason why I was a little busy last weekend. My day job, in case you're new to the podcast or unfamiliar about me, I'm the director of broadcasting for the Tampa Bay Lightning, and I have been very fortunate in the last 3 years, but also back in 2009, going to the NHL draft to help cover it for our team. And we have a 24/7 audio channel via iHeartRadio called Lightning Power Play. So we had some exclusive live broadcasting from the United Center in Chicago, talking about the draft selections that we make and trades that happen and stuff like that. Well, of course, it's not always work at these events. Granted, I had to oversee 10 hours of live unscripted broadcast over a two-day time span, but we showed up just early enough and stayed just late enough to catch a couple of baseball games. And my engineer and I, once we flew into Chicago on this past Thursday morning, we hopped into a rental car and went right up I-94 into Milwaukee to catch the Brewers and Pirates game. And if you follow us at Wax and Gum Stains, you would have seen a couple of pictures from that event on there. And I have to say, if you have never been to a Milwaukee Brewers game at Miller Park, if you find yourself in the Wisconsin area or Chicago, it's not that bad of a drive. There's some pretty extensive interstate construction going on in Chicago, so I'll slow you down. But it's only about a two-hour one-way drive. I would strongly suggest you do it because the game that I went to at Miller Park, that was fun. I mean, that was practically a giant tailgate party, to be honest with you. It was a lot of fun. Of course, it helps that the Brewers are winning and at this moment leading the National League Central Division. They're playing a Central Division rival in the Pirates. But, it was a beautiful ballpark. They had the roof open for a little bit, closed it, I think, in the third or fourth inning because it looked like it might rain. And, the food options, of course, in Milwaukee are great. You've got bratwurst hanging around left and right. Miller Genuine Draft 24-ounce cups for only, I think it was $8.75, so it's very easy to fill up on those. Reasonably priced gifts in the gift shop, and just a great atmosphere, great smells, great sounds. Bob Uecker being pumped through the speakers in the hallway, and I really love, after Take Me Out to the Ball Game, Roll Out the Barrel. And it was a really fun, festive time. So again, if you're in Wisconsin or the Milwaukee area or even Chicago anytime soon, it is well worth the drive and the effort to see a Brewers game at Miller Park. Very exciting. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but after the draft was done, my engineer and I, we very quickly went across town to, it's Guaranteed Rate Field. That is a loan provider for home loans, mortgages. And, their logo is this arrow that's pointing down, but it looks like an upside down house, which is a rather unfortunate logo to have if you're a mortgage lender. But anyways, I still call the place Comiskey Park. Even when it was called U.S. Cellular Field, I called it Comiskey Park. And the new Comiskey Park, which after it was open, and people realized that even though the old Comiskey was a dump and was falling apart, there was a certain charm to it. New Comiskey didn't have it, and they didn't have it for many years. Well, the White Sox, over the last several years, have done a lot of upgrades, made the park a lot cozier, has given it a little bit of an identity, and it's a beautiful ballpark. It also helped. It was a beautiful day. I think it was 76 degrees and sunny with a nice breeze when we saw the game. It just happened to be Mark Burley Day, the day they retired his number 56. We didn't know that when we planned this, but this is where it helps to know somebody who knows somebody, because we got A, tickets to the game, but B, really good tickets to the game. But the Comiskey Park, as I call it, or again, Guaranteed Rate Park, whatever it's called, it is not Wrigley Field. I have never been to Wrigley Field. One day I'll get there. The Cubs are on an 11-game road trip, so I couldn't do it. But if you are in Chicago, and, you know, Cubs tickets, they're expensive, they're hard to come by, I can tell you, you're still going to have a lot of fun if you go to the South Side and see the White Sox. Even though the White Sox are right now a terrible team, it's still a great ballpark and a great experience to be there. And, you know, a little pricier than Milwaukee on concessions and merchandise. That's not completely unexpected. But still, we had a lot of fun being in that ballpark. And again, the day was just absolutely gorgeous. And all the fans, one of the few times that they've filled the stadium this season, even though the White Sox got hammered by Oakland 10-2, I think most fans had a pretty good time. So if you're in Chicago, and yeah, everybody wants to see the Cubs, but it certainly doesn't hurt you if you head south, go see the White Sox. Because the team is not that good, the organization's really putting out all the stops to bring people in, so you could probably find some really good ticket deals. And I would highly recommend checking out the White Sox as well. You know, they don't quite get the credit that they deserve, because they're not the Cubs. They're not the defending world champions. They're not in the legendary Wrigley Field. So, you know, they kind of get that redheaded stepchild treatment, as the White Sox have always had in Chicago. But you definitely want to check it out if you're up there. And afterwards, a couple blocks away, there's a little bar called Cork and Carry. It's a hole-in-the-wall bar, but their owner, Bill, a friend of a friend of a friend, great guy, that seems to be the hangout right after the game. It's, like I said, a couple blocks away on the other side of Armory Park. Basically, if you go one block over in the parking lot, that's where the old Comiskey was. You've got Armory Park there, and then there's Cork and Carry there. So quick little plug for Bill, who, again, was a great guy. And I've never really spent time in Chicago prior to this weekend. The only time that I had spent in Chicago before this was changing planes at Midway, which doesn't really count. But, you know, I had a great time. Great city to visit. Yeah, I know there's a lot of bad headlines about Chicago right now. Some of it rightfully deserved. But if there's one thing that Chicago gives you, it's hospitality. And you hear about it, but when you witness it firsthand, even though I'm walking around with Tampa Bay Lightning gear and I'm clearly not there for the Chicago Blackhawks, you still had a lot of people shaking your hand, saying, "Hey, welcome to Chicago. How you doing?" And just, you know, it's the Midwestern hospitality that you hear so much about. It was great to see that firsthand in Chicago. So there you go. If you have a chance to go to Milwaukee, catch a Brewers game at Miller Park, or if you're in Chicago, check out a White Sox game. Two great venues to watch games, and it was a lot of fun, and I'm glad I was able to wedge that in, or actually kind of bookend all the work that I had to do this past weekend. Now, also this past weekend, we did post a Flashback Friday episode of our podcast, going back a few months to the 91 Top Stadium Club set, which if you haven't listened to that podcast, do give it a listen. As we look back at the great Hall of Fame career of Roberto Alomar, one of the players that clearly changed the fortunes of the Toronto Blue Jays, and a blockbuster deal that you don't necessarily see, one that helps both teams, I won't say equally, because the Blue Jays were clearly the longer-term winners than the Padres, but, you know, changing teams and swapping bona fide superstars like Fred McGriff and Tony Fernandez, sending them to San Diego, for Roberto Alomar, who was still kind of a prospect, just, you know, had a lot of upside, and Joe Carter, who had already you know, made his name as a pretty solid home run hitter with the Indians mostly, and then, you know, season with San Diego. You normally don't see trades like that anymore. But you certainly saw that back in the winter of 1990, and Roberto Alomar was able to launch what would turn out to be a Hall of Fame career in Toronto. So he was our random pull. But from the hobby standpoint, the top stadium club set in 1991 was such a step above what car companies were doing back then. And it was the first of the truly premium sets that challenged Upper Deck. Upper Deck turned the hobby on its ear in 1989 with their initial release. And the main card companies, the competition, them, you know, they just kept putting out what they put out. And in 1989 and 1990 and even 1991, the base sets, there was really nothing spectacular about those base sets. They were just part of the gluttonous hobby at the time. Well, Stadium Club was the first real answer that was head-to-head competition with Upper Deck, because without really any competition from the base sets, Upper Deck, in my opinion, just kind of coasted for those first 3 years. And by 1992, everybody else upped their game to where Upper Deck had to. And by 93, Upper Deck was kind of leading the way again with a lot of the base sets in terms of design and features and rookie stars and stuff like that. But 91 Top Stadium Club was really the first set that challenged it. It was the first branching off of a major set and a premium set. Now, I know Leaf, which came out in 1990 with some pretty nice cards, that was the parent company that was making Donruss. But this was the first brand that was extended, you know, Tops into Top Stadium Club. And you would see others would fall in line very quickly. Fleer had Fleer Ultra. Leaf came out with Leaf Studio. And that's where, you know, again, the card industry just blew up way too much by 93, 94 when all these companies were doing this. But that was the first real legitimate challenge to Upper Deck in quality and design. And in fact, a lot of the features that you see in baseball cards today, you can really take back to 91 Top Stadium Club. No borders, minimal text, minimal graphics, you know, on the back of the card, which I know some people absolutely hate, but I liked it. You know, not really a sabermetric design, but a different way of telling the stats, the completely different design on the back, you know, the background of the back, the rookie card, the Topps rookie card that was featured there. And of course, the UV coating, which is a blessing and a curse, as the UV coating protected your cards. But if you've stored a bunch of Topps Stadium Club cards in a box, they are now all stuck together and you have to very gently peel them apart if you want to look through them. So please do give a listen to that. That was our last Flashback Friday edition, looking at 91 Top Stadium Club. Now, our last episode going through the big old binder, we talked about 1970 Tops, and it's a set that I'm not a big fan of, but if you listen to the podcast, you know that there were some very good things about the 1970 Tops set. It was just, in my opinion, just another one of several meh sets. And again, I like using context when I'm talking about these cards. And, you know, I think that Topps had a glory era from 62 to 65. And Topps would also have a glory era, you know, not always great cards, but they would really ramp up design and the, you know, the creativity from 71 to, I'd say, probably, you know, certainly 75, 76. Again, not necessarily some of the best sets that they've ever made in that time period, but vastly different, more colorful, more creative than what you saw from 66 to 70. It was just a very boring period. And I sent out a tweet that said that 1970 Tops was forgettable, which riled up a few of our listeners. Saber baseball cards. That set was flat out awesome. One of my favorite sets ever. Reading the comments at Wax and Gum Stains, by the way. 29 Collector. Forgettable. I'd go with wildly underappreciated. Doug McCready. I had no issues with this set. Some good cards. Jason Carter. Don't let them shout you down. 1970 Tops were ugly. So there you go. Jason's on my side there. So there we go. CompleteYourSets.com. I see both sides of argument. Set is plain, but still looks good. League leader subset is strong, currently working on completing this set. Well, good luck with that. I hope you're able to pull that all together and find them in pretty decent shape, too. You know, those gray borders do show a little bit of wear and tear. Cardboard Clubhouse. It's a bit plain, yes, but it's still one of my favorite sets from the 70s. I'll take it over 77 Tops any day. Now, I'll differ with you on that for reasons to be explained in just a moment. Dave Michener, I wouldn't say no to finding a full set in my mailbox. I like the look. To which I responded to Dave that I would absolutely enjoy a pile of 1970 Tops sets, or cards rather, left in my mailbox. I wouldn't complain about that. And as for our random poll, Bob Aspromonte and the really entertaining story of how he and Billy Bradley got together. And as we mentioned in Wax and Gum Stains, Billy Bradley is still alive. They're still in contact with one another. And Bradley is the head of a medical center in Arkansas. And in fact, I believe he's the CEO, and he is retiring in just a few months. So he is stepping down, but we linked up to an article about his leadership, and he actually has there's a new wing or a new building of this medical center that is named after him. So it's the William Bradley Medical Center. I believe it's in Little Rock, Arkansas. And Barry W. mentions the Bob Aspromonte story is amazing. Bob Aspromonte wasn't known as a home run hitter during his major league career. And that's what makes the story amazing about how, you know, then 8-year-old Billy Bradley, who is blinded by a lightning strike, and fortunately for him, temporarily blinded, but he had to go through several major surgeries in Houston to correct the situation. You know, he's asking Aspromonte, who was not a power hitter, hey, can you hit me a home run? And you know, really my favorite part of the story is Aspromonte was trying to, you know, negotiate with him. Well, I'm not really a home run hitter. How about I just get you like 3 or 4 hits? Will that be good enough? But, you know, Aspromonte delivered in that first game, and then the second time around, Bradley came to Colt 45's game. Aspromonte hits the game-winning grand slam in the 10th inning. And then the third game that Bradley goes to during his third and final major surgery in Houston, Aspromonte hits a grand slam. I believe it was in the first inning of a game. So, you know, here's this guy who is not a power hitter, but there's something going on, something, maybe it's Providence, who knows, between these two here. And it's a very inspirational story. And again, Billy Bradley was able to help Bob Aspromonte about 10 years down the line when Aspromonte was blinded temporarily from an exploding car battery. So a very fun and inspirational story. Now, getting back to something that Cardboard Clubhouse said about taking the 70 top set over 77 tops. And, you know, it's your opinion, and I totally respect that. And that's one thing I love about our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains, because we can all share our opinions. Nobody's right or wrong. And that's especially in today's day and age where everything is so embittered. You know, I mean, it's in news. You're either Republican or Democrat, right or left, Trump or anti-Trump. And then, you know, in sports, too, it's the same thing. You know, you either love LeBron or you don't. Yankees, Red Sox, A, B, black, white, heads, tails, drives me nuts. I won't embrace the debate because there are just some things in life that are not black and white. And that is the situation here with the baseball card hobby. I'm not a big fan of 1970 Tops, even though I pull out some, you know, pretty unique things that I do like about it, especially, you know, the gray borders are nice, and I love the backs of the cards. And I mentioned that, you know, this being the last year that Tops used the white cardstock up until 1992, it makes the yellow and blue on the back of the card really pop out. It looks really nice. But, you know, if you disagree with me, I'm totally fine with that. And that's what makes this hobby fun. We can not only talk about the players, but talk about the card sets too. But something that you mentioned about how you would take 70 over 77 tops, well, I will differ with you on that because I have a fun connection to 1977 tops, and that is 1977 was my birth year. Also, being a Toronto Blue Jays fan when I was younger, that was the Blue Jays' birth year as well. So, you know, I've always had these, you know, neat little connections to the year 1977. So I always have a soft spot for 77 tops. And while I've been able to gather lots of older cards over the last few years, I don't know if I'll ever be able to pull together a complete set, but some of our listeners are doing just that. Randy Johnson. What? No, I don't think it's the big unit. No, Randy Johnson says, I want to put the set together, talking about 1970, as it was my birth year. Not the best looking 70s era set, though. And then Big Shep replies, I'm building the 79 set for the same reason. But then it led me down a path to have every top set. And he mentions he has 80 through 17 complete. Wow. He also followed up with, it's been fun. I've also had all trade update sets except for 01, 02, and 11, all in binders. It's been so much fun not trying to get into the 70s. And of course, really after 1979, as the junk wax era, as some people call it, was coming together, you were able to get a lot more of those cards. They were just more and more printed, and it's a lot easier to complete those sets. And, you know, even in the junk wax era, there are some sets that do stand out. They're actually pretty nice. And that's one of the missions of this podcast, is for some people to, you know, take a look at these sets maybe a second time and give it a little more appreciation than anything that you have before. So a lot of great conversation at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. And we're open 24/7, so you could talk about the players we talk about, the podcast we have, the sets we talk about, or just anything in general about the hobby. So as always, I ask you, please share Wax and Gum Stains with your collecting friends and remind them that the new episodes come out Tuesday mornings, 10 o'clock Eastern, via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, also Stitcher and TuneIn. And our Flashback Friday editions, we'll tweet out links to them throughout the weekend as we go back through some of our older episodes, take a second look at some of these sets. And as I mentioned, 91 Top Stadium Club was the most recent of those flashback episodes. All right, the 1971 Top set, I mentioned this in a tweet late last night when I was promoting this podcast. I call it a work of art. And 71 Tops is a work of art, even though it does drive some collectors crazy because it is very, very, very hard to find these cards in mint condition. This was, to date, the largest set that Topps put out, a whopping 752 cards. And remember, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, you had, maybe 400 cards, especially in the late 50s. But with the expansion of the major leagues to add an additional 8 teams by the end of the 1960s, you know, Major League Baseball growing from 16 teams to 24 in this very short time period, plus more people starting to collect baseball cards. In fact, if you look at the wrapper of the 71 Topps cards, and in fact, you even saw it in 1970, Topps was no longer calling itself, you know, bubblegum with picture cards. Now it was, you know, 71 Topps baseball cards or baseball picture cards with a stick of gum. So clearly the focus of Topps over the 1970-71 time period was away from promoting the confectionery aspect of their product, and that is still why they had a monopoly on the baseball card market at this time, but turning it around to, yes, we're selling you baseball cards, and oh, by the way, there's a stick of rock hard gum in here as well. So a pretty monstrous set and some pretty big players in here, several notable rookies that you will find looking through this 71 top set, including Steve Garvey, Burt Blyleven, Don Baylor, a couple members of the Big Red Machine, Dave Concepcion, George Foster. He started with the Giants but would go to Cincinnati a couple years later. Kenny Singleton, too, as well. And, of course, you've got the second-year Thurman Munson card, which is very popular for the photograph that's on there, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. And, of course, a lot of the key star players who were just starting to come up through this time, including Reggie Jackson and Nolan Ryan and Steve Carlton and, all the other big names, Pete Rose, that we've mentioned as rookie cards in previous years. You can still see some early career cards for a lot of star players, or at least players who starred throughout the 1970s and in some cases into the 1980s. Well, let's take a look at the card itself as we take a look at our random pull again. Card number 490, Darren Johnson of the Philadelphia Phillies. And I love this card for a number of reasons. We'll talk about the card design in just a moment, but the picture, you have a clash of old and new in this particular picture. It's a picture, it's kind of a far shot of Darren Johnson in baseball position, as we like to tell our kids in Little League, you know, basically squatting down, the batter's about to take a hack, and he's ready to jump into action and play the ball here. Well, Darren Johnson is wearing the new Philadelphia Phillies jersey. And this was a huge departure from what the Phillies had worn throughout much of the 1940s and 50s and 60s. Their jerseys now and since 1992 have been of that 50s and 60s design, but a very modern look for the Phillies starting in 1970. Of course, we all know it now. It was the maroon-colored Phillies with that stylistic P, the pinstripes, the very thick piping down the shoulders and the pants. And that, of course, is the uniform that was worn by the world champion Phillies in 1980. And you think of Mike Schmidt and Pete Rose and Steve Carlton and Larry Boa and Bob Boone and Tug McGraw. You think of all the members of the Phillies from that 1980 team. That is what that logo is very synonymous of. And it's very popular in throwback form, mostly in the powder blue road uniforms that the team adopted. I believe it was 1973, maybe 74. Very popular these days with not just Phillies fans, but just baseball fans in general. So here's Darren Johnson wearing this brand new Phillies logo and uniform and design. And right behind him, you see a wall. In fact, it's a big wall, a ginormous wall. This would be the right field wall in Shy Park. The Phillies last played there in the 1970 season. It was opened in 1909, the first steel and concrete baseball stadium that was constructed. And that was for a good reason, because prior to that, ballparks were made of wood and often burned down or collapsed if there were too many people in one particular section. Well, it was in the late 1920s, I believe, when the Philadelphia Athletics were a very competitive ball team, won the World Series a couple times. Connie Mack, their owner, was not pleased that the row of houses beyond right field, very similar to what you see at Wrigley Field now. You have the houses behind right field, and you know, people would sit up on the roof or sit out on balconies and watch the game for free. Well, he didn't really like that. So he built, I think they called it the spite wall in right field. Basically just added 30 feet of wall on top of the wall where the ball was in play, just to block the view of all the houses beyond right field. Now, the row of houses would have the last laugh as the Phillies left Shy Park in 1970 and moved into Veterans Stadium for the 71 season. Shy Park was left rotting, burned to the ground in 76, eventually got demolished. And there's a church there now, and that's a lot of baseball fans know that. There's a church on the plot of land that Shy Park was on. But the row of houses that Connie Mack tried to block, they're still there. So they've been around for probably about a century now, while the block of land that the ballpark was on was basically refurbished for a higher power about 40 years ago. So I've always just liked this particular picture, just seeing, you know, Darren Johnson, you know, in this brand spanking new Phillies jersey playing in front of the spite wall in the crumbling Shy Park in the 1970 season. Now, I'll talk about other aspects of the picture in a moment, but let's take a look at the card in general. First, you have the legendary black borders, and it's actually kind of hard to see because I shot this against a dark blue background here. You know, the card kind of gets swallowed up in it. The one thing that shows you where the borders are is the fading of the sides, and this is what drives collectors crazy. They love the design of the card, but it's so hard to find these cards in, you know, pristine condition or anything close to it, because once they got handled a few times, they would show the wear and tear specifically on the corners, but often throughout the entire side of the card. So in terms of wear and tear that I've seen on 71 Topps cards, this Darren Johnson card actually is not that bad, but I've seen some that have really taken a beating, and there are some that look particularly nice. Now, if you're buying 71 Topps cards, especially star cards or big rookie cards, bring a ruler or bring another common 71 Topps card, lay one on top of the other. Make sure that you're not buying a card that has been trimmed, and that is something that's been a problem for this hobby for decades, actually. People trying to take advantage of customers by trimming maybe 1/16th of an inch off the sides to make the card appear better looking than it actually is. Now, you have the black border, but what also makes this card striking is you've got about 85% of the card is devoted to the picture. And again, using kind of the Kodachrome feel that you see in early 70s photography, some of these pictures are absolutely striking just in terms of color and contrast and stuff like that. Now, at the top, in big block capital letters, is the team name. In lowercase letters, the player's name right beneath the team, and then there's a dot separating his name and his position. Now, I said during our 59 Topps podcast that was the only set where the player name was in lowercase letters. I'm obviously wrong there. 71 Topps is as well. And that really creates an interesting aspect here to the card as a whole. I called 59 Topps the Mad Men set. It was very modern advertising, modern promotional marketing look with the vibrant colors and the lowercase letters and the picture in a circle in the middle of this rectangular card. This was also very representative of a lot of advertising and just the kind of the look and the feel of 1971 after the crazy, hazy late 1960s, and the rest of the world is kind of waking up groggy in 1970, there was a notably conservative turn, especially in the United States in 1971. In fact, that is the running line to the legendary Who song, "We Won't Be Fooled Again." You know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. So after all of this upheaval and craziness in the late 60s, well, guess what? You know, the white guy is still president and people are still being oppressed here, and we're putting back on our suits and ties and trimming our hair and beard, and life goes on. So there was a very notorious turn back to the 1970s conservatism back then. And you can definitely see that in this 1971 set. It is artistic, but it is very clean and crisp and sharp and very mod, to borrow another term from that same time. This is very representative of the time, of the values, of the designs, where you have bright colors on top of dark objects, and all you have to do is, you know, and this is what I said in the 59 and even the 58 top set, you know, you look back at some of the advertising from that time, do the same thing here, you know, find old National Geographic or Life magazines and flip through them, you know, from 1971, and you'll see a lot of the same elements in the advertising then as you see right here in this particular card. So it's a striking set, and it's just beautiful how the colors mesh in with the black border, with the lowercase letters on the player name, with the pictures too, not just taking up most of the card, but the quality of the pictures, the colors, and the contrast. It really pops out off of this black backdrop. Now, what also pops out in 1971, and I mentioned the Thurman Munson card, this was the first year that Topps attempted action shots. Now, in previous sets, specifically the World Series and playoff review cards, you would have action shots, you know, a pitcher delivering a pitch, or, you know, a guy sliding into home, you know, kind of this, year in review or World Series in review highlight card. you saw that in the late 60s in the 1970 Topps set. So this wasn't really the first time that Topps really did it, but this was the first time they tried to extend it to the entire set. So Darren Johnson here, yes, this is an action card as he's awaiting for the ball to be hit into play. But this is not the biggest action card that you see. The Munson card is legendary. First of all, it is a horizontal card, and Topps hadn't done any horizontal player cards since the 1960 set. And again, in 1960, those were all pose shots. There was an action shot included in the card, but it was still mostly an artistic card and certainly not an action shot. Well, the Munson card, you have a member of the Oakland A's sliding into home, and there's Munson blocking the plate, and presumably the runner is out, and there's a cloud of dirt all around both of them. And to make it seem even more award-winning, you have the Topps Rookie Award trophy in the lower left-hand corner. So it really does seem like it's award-winning. That is one of the more legendary action photos. The Nolan Ryan card is another one. Ryan, still with the Mets at the time, in the middle of delivering a pitch off the mound at Shea Stadium. There's another card that I have that looks really cool, and that's Dal Maxville, who was a shortstop for the St. Louis Cardinals, later the general manager for the Cardinals, was at the helm of the 85 and 87 teams that went to the World Series. But Maxville was not known for his bat. He was known for his fielding. And the 71 Topps card for Maxville certainly shows that, as he is actually in midair starting a double play against the Mets in Shea Stadium. So you have some real winners, but then you have some really head-scratching ones. A lot of the times when a player was shown at bat, in mid-swing, if you take a close look at the body positioning after the swing, on the follow-through, it's pretty clear the player has struck out, so it's not has swung at a strike. It's not a very flattering action photo. And also, you have some action shots that are shot from miles away. The Darren Johnson shot is a great example where you see him in action, but this is clearly done before the days of super zoom lenses. This was shot probably in the camera well next to the dugout, and it looks like Darren Johnson is about 30 feet away from the photographer. One example is the Bud Harrelson card, where much like Dal Maxville, Bud Harrelson is in the middle of a double play ball here, the middle infielder for the Mets at the time. And the picture, it seems to be shot from the fourth row in the third deck of Shea Stadium. It's just such a wide shot. You don't even know which player that's on the card is Bud Harrelson. So there were some downsides to the action shots, but in general, people love them. People still love them because it was such a big change from the static posed shots that baseball cards had been doing for 20 plus years, at least in the modern era. Of course, in all honesty, you go back to the late 1800s when tobacco cards were started. It's always been posed shots, whether it's just the player standing there or the player pretending to swing a bat or throw a pitch. So that was pretty game-changing right there. Topps was really dipping its toe into the water on action shots, and that is something that you would see in pretty much every baseball card set moving forward. And nowadays, if a baseball card features a shot of a player that isn't an action shot, it's very unusual. You're like, wait a minute, why is this picture of Mike Trout just standing there? You want to see Mike Trout in action, making a great catch or, hitting a home run or something like that. You don't just want that posed shot. So it's become a staple of baseball cards for almost 50 years now. Now, it would also lead, as Topps experimented more and more with action shots, it would lead into some hilariously awful action shots in later years. Specifically, the 73 Topps set had some notable oddball action shots, 74 Topps as well. And you would see Topps kind of dial back on the action shots, especially in 75 and 76. I think you would see some in 77. But they kind of pulled back a little bit because some of the cards in 73 and 74 were just so bizarre. They were trying to force the action shots in there, and it just didn't look good. Now, something that did look good, the back of the 71 Topps card. So let's take a look at the back of the Darren Johnson card. Card number 490, one of the most unique card backs in baseball card history. First of all, the color. We've got the avocado green, which I did not like in the 67 Topps set. And I will say this, I'm not crazy about it because the 71 Topps set is using the gray card stock, not the white card stock. So it's just very, very dark. So it does make for some hard-to-read cards, and especially depending on the print run, sometimes the card stock or the ink that was used for the green background is a tad bit darker than the normal run. So you do have some hard-to-read cards. So while it is very representative of the time, and I said this in the 67 Topps podcast, those of us who were alive in the 70s at some point in time, we all remember everybody had at one point in time either an avocado green car or a refrigerator or an oven or shag carpeting. You know, it's a very, very memorable color because it was just so hideously ugly. But what kind of makes up for it is the overall design of this card, which is actually somewhat of a modernized version of the 62 top set. Now, the biggest change is that as opposed to a cartoon in the upper left-hand corner, you have a photograph of the player. And this was another big earth-shattering change in 1971, the first time that you had a photo of the player on the back of the card. And it's on this kind of angled, almost cartoonish picture frame here. So it stands out there. And then much like the 62 Topps set, you have a very brief statement of this player's performance, along with a very interesting little stat line. First year in pro ball, and in Darren Johnson's case, 1956, and first game in majors, in his case, 1960. And you had the personal information of the player up there too, the height, weight, birth, town, and all that stuff. Now, because so much space was dedicated to this big picture, this floating head on the back of the card, and this little text box on the right side, the stats had to be boiled down to just one line. So again, this is something that you saw in 1962, and it would come back again in 1971, and you haven't seen it since. So the major league record, batting or pitching for the 1971 cards, features one line for 1970, and one line for his career stats. So it's an interesting mixed bag because I'm always a fan of showing the complete professional record of the player on the back there. But this is a little bit of a throwback to what Topps did kind of on an on and off basis, an alternating basis in the 50s and 60s. One year they would have the full stats. The next year they would have this little two-line summary. The next year full stats. The next year two lines, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something that ended in 62. So even though I'm not crazy about the colors and I'm not crazy about the stats, I've liked this design because much like the front of the card was something completely different from the norm. After several years of just this kind of ho-hum product that was pushed out, the back of the 71 top stands out. At the very least, it is unique. And it's something, again, you haven't seen since. So the big floating head on the background, the color combination, the unique stats and storytelling, I actually give this a thumbs up, if you will, because much like the front of the card was something completely different than what baseball fans saw from the previous few years, certainly the back of the card, something they hadn't seen in nearly a decade. So in all, 71 Topps is an absolute must collect. Now, again, if you're looking for, you know, gem mint condition cards, forget about it. If you try to track down a set in that good of condition, you will spend thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars trying to find it. Because ever since the day that professional grading came out about 20 years ago, that elevated price is so much of an already hard to find in mint condition set that it's almost impossible unless you've just got a ton of money and time. It's not really worth it. However, because this is a pretty big set, 592 cards, as I mentioned, and it's been well handled, you know, ever since it's been through the hands of kids back in the 70s through adults over the last 45 plus years, There are plenty of cars that are out there. They're not in great condition, but you can still get them, again, in a big lot at your local card store or online, you know, through eBay lots. They're a little pricier than some of the other cards because, again, it's a set that's in demand. But I would say on average, you can probably find a common car for 20, 25 cents. So for about $20, you can get, you know, maybe 60 or 70 cards that are not in tremendously great shape, but are overall in pretty good condition. What also adds to the madness here is the last series of the set. There are some double print cards out there, but the series prior to that, I believe that would be series 6, that was a short print series. So some cards are a little harder to find than others. Some cards are very plentiful. So keep that in mind if you're looking to collect a handful of 71 Topps cards. But if you don't already have some, even if they're not star players, they're just common cards, I think if you can find a handful of these cards somewhere at a decent price, absolutely get them. One, because, again, it's a historical piece of baseball memorabilia right here. You know, you're almost at the 50-year stage when you go back to 1971. But also, this is a work of art. It is a beautiful card. It is a card that, you're never, I shouldn't say never, because we've seen some black border cards then, but you never really see something exactly like this again, mostly because collectors hate it in the sense that you can't keep them in mint condition forever. But this is just one of those brilliant strokes of timing with the design, and especially because it was such an improvement over the previous 5 sets that Topps put out. 71 Topps is just an absolute masterpiece in design, photography, and certainly in terms of star collections. I mentioned all the big rookie cards there, and all those big rookies from the early to mid-60s were now star players here. So it's very easy, again, if you're not too concerned about condition of cards, to find some very, very beautiful cards in this set at a relatively cheap price given the condition that they may be in. Now, as I mentioned, 71 Topps was not the last card set that you saw with a black border. It was the last Topps set. I should take that back. No, they did do black borders in 2007, I believe it was. But, those didn't quite exactly have the same magic as the 71 Topps set. You did see black border cards from Donruss in 1985 and 1987. Also, Score in 1991, every 110 cards in that massive 900-card set. Basically, it was kind of a series within the series. They would alternate colors. You had a dark blue. You had kind of a teal color. But you also had black. So you had two series of black cards within the entire 91 Score set. So that was not quite as legendary as 71 Topps. But I know collectors kind of like that throwback look, as long as the condition of the cards could be kept at a pretty decent level, which, trust me, as somebody who collected a lot of 87 Donruss and 91 Score, that was not a very easy thing to do. All right, now as for Darren Johnson, again, this is a guy who, I don't like saying forgotten because, you're not truly forgotten, but, here's a guy that kind of gets lost in the shuffle because, he has been gone for a long time. He passed away in 1992. But he's a guy that played on some not-so-good teams, so you tend to forget him, and that's rather unfortunate because this guy was just an incredible hitter. 245 home runs in a 16-year career that's stretching over 1,765 games, and that's also including really the last 4 or 5 years of his career. He wasn't a regular player in the lineup for many teams. He was mostly, an over-the-hill designated hitter and was bouncing around from one team to another. And again, typically they were not very good teams throughout the final few years of his career. But he started in the New York Yankees system back in 1960. He was actually a native child of the San Diego area, of course, a hotbed for baseball players then. And he was a star baseball and football player at San Diego High School. He could play several different positions in football, and he was scouted by some top colleges. He had the option to play at Notre Dame in the late 1950s. How crazy is that? But he was also very highly scouted by Major League Baseball programs, not just the Yankees, but also reportedly the Pirates and the Braves, the Red Sox, the Indians. They were all ready to throw, you know, the baby bonus contracts at him. Well, he decided not to go with the bonus baby, I should say, not baby bonus, but the bonus baby route. He decided to go the other way and work his way up through the farm system. And he did that in the Yankee system and was called the next Mickey Mantle. Ugh. Yeah, that does not bode well. You know, it's good that they want to compare you to Mickey Mantle, but whenever you're called the next so-and-so, that normally doesn't bode well. And as it would turn out, Mantle was able to fight through a lot of injuries and bad luck in the early 60s to stretch his career through 1968, even though it petered out over the final few years. But Darren Johnson wasn't going to be a guy that would be around with the Yankees long enough. He did have a cup of coffee in the 1960 season, appeared in a handful of games in 1961 with the Yankees as well. But, and I've told this story before, the Yankees were, as long as Arnold Johnson was the owner of the Kansas City Athletics, the Yankees and the Athletics had basically a trade pipeline going back and forth. The Athletics were essentially a minor league ball club for the New York Yankees. So he is traded to the Athletics in 1961. And the Athletics, of course, not very good. He spends a couple of years there really on a part-time and platoon basis and going back and forth between the major leagues and minor leagues. Now, in fact, he has a little bit of a reawakening in 1963. He is sent down to the minors, and he's finally able to find his confidence, find his stroke once again, and get things going back in the right direction. In fact, it was the San Diego Padres of the Pacific Coast League. He hits 33 home runs, has 91 RBI. He led the Pacific Coast League in home runs, was fifth in the RBI department, and represented the Padres in the PCL All-Star Game. Now, I should mention that the Padres were a farm club of the Cincinnati Reds at that time. He was purchased by the Reds from the Athletics right before the 1963 season started. So the Reds are taking a very good look at Darren Johnson here, and he puts up such a great performance in 63 in San Diego that he earns the promotion to Cincinnati in 1964, and this is really where his career takes off. Plays 140 games with the Reds, 21 home run, 79 RBI, and things would just get better the next year. 1965, he's 26 years old and really hitting his stride here. 159 games played, 32 home runs, 130 RBI. And what helped out was he was hitting behind Frank Robinson. So, you know, Frank Robinson could still mash the ball for the Reds. Pitchers were aware of that, so they would dance around Robinson, and Johnson would get some pretty good pitches, and he certainly made the best of the opportunity. Hit 287 that year as well. Now, the Reds were in the playoff race, but faded at the tail end of the 1965 season. And this is when the infamous Frank Robinson to Baltimore trade happens in December of 1965. Bill DeWitt, the general manager of the Reds, infamously calls Robinson an old 31 on the backside of his career. He certainly made no bones that he was pushing Robinson out of the way because he wanted to move this quote-unquote aging outfielder out and also bring in a new pitcher. So thus the rather dubious trade of Robinson to the Baltimore Orioles for Milt Pappas and a couple other players. Pappas was the big key there. Well, Pappas didn't quite work out for the Reds. Robinson, of course, goes on to win a World Series with the Orioles that next season. And the Robinson for Pappas trade goes down in Reds history as arguably the worst trade in Reds history. Now, I will top that by saying the Reds never should have traded Paul O'Neill to the Yankees. And you can argue that that trade was even worse. Listen to our archive podcast on the 1990 Bowman set to hear that story as I go into great detail about how the O'Neill trade to the Yankees was probably worse than the Robinson trade to the Orioles. But I digress, and so did the Reds in 1966. While the Dodgers are able to fight off the Reds and a few other teams, the Giants as well, and the Pirates down the stretch in the 1966 season, the Reds are fading fast, and a guy like Darren Johnson, who benefited from having Frank Robinson hitting him in front of him in the lineup, certainly took a big beating, lost 30 points in his batting average, hits 24 home runs, 81 RBI, but you know, clearly Johnson is feeling the effect of a Reds team without Frank Robinson in the lineup. Now, the good news for the Reds is that this goof-up by Bill DeWitt, by moving Frank Robinson, while it knocked them back a couple pegs, it would eventually form the foundation of what would become the Big Red Machine, a very successful Cincinnati Reds team throughout the 1970s. Now, as for Darren Johnson, he continues to play in Cincinnati in 1967 and then gets moved on to the Atlanta Braves prior to the 1968 season, as he was traded by Cincinnati for Jim Beauchamp, Mac Jones, and Jay Ritchie. So he plays the season in Atlanta, gets purchased by the Philadelphia Phillies, and that is really where, you know, second to Cincinnati, where he had a pretty lengthy stay. A regular first baseman, a guy who would average, I'd say, probably about 23, 24 home runs, about 90 RBI, and that was pretty impressive for a not-so-impressive Phillies team, which was, at that time, forming the foundation of that solid Phillies team in the late 70s and the team that would eventually win the World Series in 1980. In the middle of the 73 season, he was mercifully traded away from Philadelphia for a minor leaguer, Jack Bastable, and he's traded to Oakland, and that is where he picks up his one and only World Series championship in 1973 against the Mets. In the middle of the 74 season, things start going downhill here in that he's bouncing around from team to team, primarily as a designated hitter. June of 1974, he's traded from Oakland to Milwaukee. September of 74, he is picked up by Boston from Milwaukee, and then he is released by the Red Sox in October of 1974. The 75 season comes around. The Chicago White Sox, who were infamous for picking up aging players, signing them to one-year deals, and then trading them away for other aging players who could be signed to one-year deals. Well, he starts with the White Sox in 75, traded to the Boston Red Sox again late in 75, but when I say late, this was after the roster expansion. This is September 21st, so he was not on the postseason roster for the Red Sox in their run to the World Series in 1975. Lost to Darren Johnson's former team, the Cincinnati Reds. And then his career will conclude after appearing in only a handful of games, 15 games in 1976 with the Red Sox, as he was released by Boston on June 4th of that year. So again, 1,765 games, 245 home runs, 247 doubles. So this guy could, you know, put some power into the power alleys, 923 RBI, and as I mentioned, a world champion in 1973. And let's not forget, too, that in his first extended time in the American League after a pretty lengthy period in the National League, almost 10 years in the National League, he was able to adjust rather well and produce for that Oakland team, part of the swinging A's back in 1973. He was never an all-star, but believe it or not, was in the MVP race a few times, including in 1965 when he had that great season with Cincinnati, also a very distant runner in the MVP race in 1970 with Philadelphia and 1973 with Oakland. Now, he could not only hit a ton of home runs, but he could hit home runs a ton, as in distance. He was known as a pretty solid hitter. In fact, Pete Rose, when he was with Cincinnati, said he had never seen somebody hammer a ball as hard as Darren Johnson could. And that's saying a lot, considering Rose was on a team with Frank Robinson and later guys like Johnny Bench and George Foster, to name a few. So that's quite the compliment there. Now, after his playing career wound down, He would move on into coaching. In 1978, he went to Salt Lake City, part of the Pacific Coast League, and got Salt Lake City into a second-place finish, falling in the playoff semifinals that year. And then he was back to coaching in the major leagues, the hitting coach for the Angels in 1979 when the team finally made the postseason. He was there for a couple of seasons, then went on to the Mets, the Phillies, the Mariners, the White Sox, and then back to the Angels in the late 80s, wrapping up his career in 1991. Now, in June of 1991, he was diagnosed with lung cancer and unfortunately died less than a year later, April 23rd, 1992. He was only 53 years old. And according to our friends at SABRE, that, of course, being the Society for American Baseball Research, in an article written by John Vorpirian, I hope I'm pronouncing that name right, Darren Johnson's greatest thrills were playing for the World Series champion Athletics in 1973 and also putting his notch in the Phillies history book when he hit four home runs in a row in July of 1971, three in one game against the Montreal Expos. Of course, the Expos in 1971, not very good, but Darren Johnson would make that awful pitching staff pay for serving up meatballs down the center of the plate with three home runs in one game, and then his first at-bat the next game, hitting his fourth consecutive homer. So there you go, Darren Johnson, unfortunately somewhat forgotten home run hitter, most notably with the Philadelphia Phillies, but also for many years with the Cincinnati Reds, and then the world champion Oakland A's in 1973, our random pull from 71 Tops, card number 490. Love the 71 Top set. Want to hear your thoughts about the 71 Top set or the career and life of Darren Johnson? You can respond to us via Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains at any time. And we'll take a look ahead to the next set as well, our next new podcast following our Flashback Friday episode, which we'll release this weekend. Next Tuesday at 10 o'clock, we will take a look at another work of art. But this isn't quite the serious, buttoned-up, really mod look of art of 1971. No, 72 Tops would definitely be pop art. It is the Andy Warhol of baseball cards. It's got a whole lot of Electric Company and 3-2-1 Contact wrapped up into it. Those of you old enough to remember those TV shows from back in the day. Maybe a little H.R. Puffin stuff as well. There's a whole lot of 70s happening in the 72 Top set, so we will discuss that. Also, don't forget, if you're listening to this before noon Eastern on Wednesday, June the 28th, we have our 84 Tops rack pack with the Tony Gwynn card showing on the back of one of the packs up for auction, and we will show you the video of that pack break later on this week. So we got a whole lot coming up for you. The 84 Tops break to a lucky winner, lucky auction winner, coming up later this week. We've got our Flashback Friday episode and also our 72 Tops podcast that will be next Tuesday at 10 a.m. New podcast, archive podcast, always available via Audio Boom and iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Stitcher. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you again for joining me today for another episode of Wax Ecstatic. Talk to you next time.